This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Getting Things Done, The Art of Stress-Free Productivity by David Allen. Read by the author.
Introduction to the Revised Edition. What follows is a total rewrite of the first edition of Getting Things Done, originally published in 2001. Well, a sort of rewrite. I actually retyped the original manuscript, start to finish, with the goal of identifying and revising content and language that was either incomplete, outdated, or otherwise not optimal for keeping the book functional as a continuing and evergreen manual, one that would be useful globally and remain relevant and applicable for the 21st century and even beyond. I also wanted to incorporate the most significant and interesting things I've seen and learned about the methodology that Getting Things Done introduced, as I've continued to be involved with it in myriad ways since the book's first publication. That includes my own deeper understanding of its power, subtlety, and range of application, as well as how it has been received as awareness of it has spread around the world. What didn't need to change as I reassessed the book were its fundamental principles and core techniques. As I crafted this new edition, reacquainting myself with what I wrote then was a gratifying acknowledgement that the principles of stress-free productivity I described, and even most of the best practices of how to apply them, haven't wavered, nor will they, in the foreseeable future. In order for a space exploration team to land on Jupiter in 2109, they will have to employ the same principles for maintaining control and focus as anyone does today. They'll still need some version of an in-tray, explained later, to capture potentially meaningful inputs they didn't expect in order to trust their choices about what to focus on during their first excursion. And next action decision-making will always be critical for successful execution of any task, whatever its scope. Because many elements of the way we live and work have changed since the first edition, though, I've made appropriate recalibrations in the fundamental material and will share my thoughts here about things that I consider new and interesting in this arena, offering relevant advice to both those new to this methodology and the Getting Things Done aficionados who may be listening to this edition and want to keep abreast of the latest developments concerning it. What's new? Here are some of the key areas in the What's New category that have influenced my revision. The rise of digital technology. The continuing manifestation of Moore's Law, digital processing power increasing exponentially over time, along with the social and cultural ramifications of the expansion of the digital world into our daily lives, never fails to surprise, delight, and overwhelm us. Because Getting Things Done deals primarily with the content and meaning of what we need to manage, irrespective of how it shows up or gets organized, whether in digital form or on paper, advances in technology are to some degree irrelevant to the essence of its methodology. An email request means essentially the same thing and has to be processed the same way as a favor asked of you at the coffee machine. But the wired wireless world has both enhanced and exacerbated how we can apply the core practices of capturing, organizing, and accessing what's meaningful. While we now have access to lots of super tools and apps that show up on an almost daily basis and do really great stuff, that plethora of options can easily blow our productivity fuses. Staying on top of and leveraging ever-evolving technologies adds significant pressure to getting one's appropriate workflow methodology right. I've accordingly changed some of my earlier emphases on types of tools that are best suited to particular tasks and acknowledge the ubiquity of our new digital and mobile world. I've also eliminated most of my references to specific software applications that appeared in the first edition. The rate of innovation in this area means that any specific software program can easily be outdated, upgraded, or undermined by the next new thing by the time you hear about it. I've essentially hopped out of that fray, opting instead to provide a general model for how to evaluate the usefulness of any tool. For this edition, I grappled with how much attention to continue to devote to paper-based tools and materials, especially for capturing, reference filing, and incubating, as many in the younger generations have come to believe they don't have to deal with paper at all. At the risk of dating myself, I decided to leave most of those instructions from the first edition intact here, as many of the potential readers and listeners of this new edition around the world will still be at least partially paper-based. Ironically, there's a growing resurgence of interest in the use of paper among the most sophisticatedly digital. Time will tell whether we can ever truly get rid of that in-your-hand, in-your-face medium. By the way, as I write this, I'm in the middle of a move to Europe from the U.S., attempting to reduce my physical possessions to a bare minimum. So I scanned and digitized everything in my physical tickler file, which I have used for 30 years, described later. Already I've been frustrated several times with things that would have been much more easily handled had I kept the physical version. The 24/7 world. I'm often asked what new advice GTD, getting things done abbreviated, can offer to the mobile, connected, and always-on world. The necessity of dealing with frequent and complex barrages of potentially significant data was probably true in the past for remarkable individuals such as Napoleon as he marched through Europe, or Bach as he composed, or even Andy Warhol as he decided what to paint or show in a gallery. Now, though, the entire world's digitally connected literate population is the recipient of an explosion of nonstop, potentially important, or at least relevant, information. The ease with which it can be accessed through technology has made it simultaneously rewarding in its opportunities and treacherous in its volume, speed, and changeability. If you are by nature fascinated by what may be going on when you hear sirens in your neighborhood, or wonder what a group of people across the room at a party is excitedly talking about, then you are ripe for becoming a victim of the endless and powerful distractions your personal technology dishes out to you. Whether your experience with it is ultimately positive or negative depends primarily on the application of the practices in this book. The globalization of GTD methodology. I'm often asked if the GTD process can translate into other cultures, and my answer has always been a resounding, of course. The core message of the book is so inherently relevant to the human condition that I've yet to experience any cultural bias, nor frankly any gender, age, or personality type differentials in the applicability of the methodology. The awareness of the need for it and what purposes it will serve will, of course, be different for each individual. But that is more a function of one's station in life, the nature of one's work, and one's interest in self-improvement than it is any of the other factors. In actual practice, you will potentially have more in common with many hundreds of thousands of people around the world in your resonance with GTD than you will with your next-door neighbor or even your cousin Raphael. Since its initial publication, awareness of the Getting Things Done message has spread worldwide. The first edition has been translated into more than 30 languages, and our company has established franchises in many countries to provide training programs based on its content. While I was relatively confident about the cross-cultural coherence of this methodology when I wrote the book, the ensuing years have simply validated that confidence in spades. An approach that is more inclusive of a larger population of readers, listeners, and users. The primary impetus for my writing Getting Things Done was to craft a manual for the methodology that I had formulated, tested, and implemented, mostly in the corporate training and development world. In its examples, style, look, and feel, I wore a tie on the cover, the book was initially and principally addressed to managers, executives, and higher-level fast-track professionals. While I already knew that the material could be equally valuable for homemakers, students, clergy, artists, and even retirees, it was professionals who at that time were the most aware of the need for the kind of help I was seeking to provide, as a means both to advance their own development and productivity, as well as to stay sane in the process. They were at the front lines, the advance guard, in engaging with the impending flood of information and rapid and significant change the business world was experiencing, and also had access to resources to tackle these issues. Today, there is a much more universal interest in the results that can be achieved with relaxed, focused control, and the realization that it is not just a one-shot recipe of time management tips simply for business professionals, but in fact a lifestyle practice necessary to deal with the new world most all of us are experiencing. I regularly receive testimonials from a diversity of people around the world in an infinite variety of situations about the life-changing value they've experienced applying GTD principles. This validation of the growing need across the planet for such a model has inspired me to reframe many of my examples and the focus of that text to support it. From that perspective, I have to acknowledge that even the title of this book can be somewhat misleading, giving many the impression that I am somehow advocating working harder and longer to get more done. Productivity, unfortunately, does have connotations of both business and busyness. In truth, this book is not so much concerned with getting things done as it is championing appropriate engagement with your world, guiding you to make the best choice of what to do in each moment and to eliminate distraction and stress about what you're not doing. The resulting clarity and psychological space can benefit a much broader range of people than simply professionals on a corporate career track. Some of the most interesting endorsements of the value of applying the Getting Things Done principles and techniques have come from unexpected quarters. The head of the world's largest finance organization, a popular American comedian, the most listened to U.S. radio personality, the CEO of a major European conglomerate, one of the most successful Hollywood directors, all have attributed huge benefits in their life and work to GTD. Feedback from the clergy of many different religions has also been fascinating. While they are responsible for handling otherworldly matters, they've been starved for ways to focus more in that realm with their flocks by freeing themselves of the distractions of the day-to-day business aspects of leading a congregation. Students, designers, doctors, the list of self-identified GTD advocates is endless. Over the years, I've discovered that we're all in this game together. It's now great to have the opportunity to frame an outreach to encompass the full breadth of GTD users. A greater awareness of the time and energy required for the full implementation of the GTD process and the behavioral changes required to maintain it. Alas, as easy as it is to actually do what I suggest as best practices in this book, I have been rudely awakened to these two phenomena. One, the amount of information and suggested activities here can easily be perceived as too overwhelming for someone to even begin to implement them. And two, making some of the fundamental practices habitual can take quite a while for most people. Because I have continued to resist dumbing down this model and its details, I'm not sure I can ever overcome the objection of too much to absorb. The first edition of Getting Things Done included detailed instructions and recommendations about how to fully implement its methodology in your life and work, and I have retained them here. I now know that for many who are new to this game, this will seem more than comfortable or possible to incorporate all at once. But I cannot with integrity hold back the instructions about how to really integrate this method into your everyday life if you want to go for it. If you were interested in learning to play tennis, I wouldn't want to hold back at least a blueprint of the game, including a vision of excellence and the levels of learning and practice involved to get there. In the newly added Chapter 15, I've sought to illuminate the depth and breadth of the game I'm introducing, and to make it more comfortable for you to take what you can and will from what you hear, and make it okay for you to simply glean and implement whatever you might from it, for now. I've attempted in this version of the book to add more graciousness to respect the potentially daunting task of rearranging your personal practices and systems. It's really all about one step at a time. In every case, however, a key challenge is applying and sustaining these practices as an ongoing set of habits, to the point that they will require the minimal application of conscious focus, or juice, and merely become an everyday part of keeping one's mental and physical environment in good order. I cannot pretend to be an expert in how to change one's habits. I've been much more invested in figuring out and refining the practices of stress-free productivity. An excellent resource in this area is Charles Duhigg's book, The Power of Habit. The behavioral ingredients of GTD are actually relatively simple and familiar to everyone. How hard is it to write something down, decide what the next step is to move it forward, record the reminder of that on a list, and review the list? Most everyone admits he or she needs to establish a practice like this, and few do it consistently enough to feel good about it. how challenging it is for someone to internalize the need to consistently keep every unnecessary distraction out of his or her head has been one of my biggest surprises over the years. Information from cognitive science research that has validated the efficacy of the GTD methodology. I no longer feel as much like a voice crying in the wilderness as I did at the turn of the century, for since then, scientific data has emerged validating the principles and practices prescribed in this book. The new chapter 14 here, GTD and Cognitive Science, features an examination of some of this research. If you are new to this, and if you've gotten this far in the introduction, you're probably interested in jumping in at some level of engagement. I've structured Getting Things Done as a practical manual, much like a cookbook that frames the basic principles, presents many layers of what cooking and serving a meal is all about, and gives enough specific recipes to enable you to make an infinite number of future dinners. If I've done a decent job in crafting this new edition, you can just start at the next chapter and take it from there as you feel so moved. GTD principles, as they are laid out in the book, have been verified by many as a powerful experience to work through and apply. Or you can simply jump around, skim the text, randomly dive into a paragraph or two. The book has been written to serve you in that way as well. If you already have some Getting Things Done experience, this will still be a new book. Over the many years that this information has been available in multiple forms, whenever anyone loops back through the material, they invariably have a response like, "Oh my God, this is totally different information and perspective than I could recognize and absorb when I read it earlier." Even people who have reread the original edition of GTD as many as 5 times have professed to me it was a totally different book each time. The experience is very much like reading a software manual a year later, after you've gotten the basics on cruise control. You'll be amazed and enthused about all the cool stuff you realize you could be doing right at your fingertips, but that you couldn't recognize and implement, given the other major issues that needed to be addressed to set things up. No matter when or how many times you might have read or listened to an earlier version of Getting Things Done, or participated in any of the seminars, coaching, webinars, podcasts, or other presentations of this material, you will experience a novel and absorbing level of engagement in this revised edition. I promise you that. What will open up in the following program is a new universe of ideas to incorporate within the structure and tools you likely already have in place. Engaging with this book and the information within it will consistently provide a positive and productive mindset about the aspects of your life and work that genuinely matter. Welcome to Getting Things Done. Welcome to a goldmine of insights into strategies for how to have more energy, be more relaxed, with more clarity and presence in the moment with whatever you're doing, and get a lot more accomplished with much less effort. If you're like me, you like getting things done and doing them well, and yet you also want to savor life in ways that seem increasingly elusive, if not downright impossible, if you're working too hard. This doesn't have to be an either-or proposition. It is possible to be effectively doing while you are delightfully being in your ordinary workaday world. I think efficiency is a good thing. Maybe what you're doing is important, interesting, or useful, or maybe it isn't, but it has to be done anyway. In the first case, you want to get as much return as you can on your investment of time and energy. In the second, you want to get on to other things as fast as you can, without any nagging loose ends. And whatever you're doing, you'd probably like to be more relaxed, confident that whatever you're doing at the moment is just what you need to be doing, that having a beer with your staff after hours, gazing at your sleeping child in his or her crib at midnight, answering the email in front of you, or spending a few informal minutes with the potential new client after the meeting is exactly what you ought to be doing as you're doing it. Teaching you how to be maximally efficient and relaxed whenever you need or want to be was my main purpose in writing this book. And after many years of sharing this information and set of best practices around the world, in the most varied environments and with the widest range of people of all types and ages, I can unequivocally attest it works. How do you know that what you're doing is what you ought to be doing at any point in time? No software, seminar, cool notebook, smartphone, or even personal mission statement will give you more than 24 hours in a day, simplify its content, or make this often tough choice for you. Used appropriately, those kinds of tools can provide support for your decisions, but they don't in and of themselves get you in control and focused. What's more, just when you learn how to enhance your productivity at one level, you'll graduate or be forced to the next accepted batch of responsibilities and creative goals, whose new challenges will defy the ability of any simple formula, buzzword du jour, or new digital mobile device to get you back on your game for your next stage in work and life. You may have established personal habits and tools that work for a while, but a major change, such as a big shift in your job, a first baby, or buying a home, will test their sustainability and likely create serious discomfort, if not havoc. But if there's no single technique or tool for perfecting organization and productivity, there are very specific things we do to facilitate them. Over the years, I've uncovered simple processes that we can all learn to use that will vastly improve our ability to deal proactively and constructively with the mundane realities of the world, while still feeling connected to our more meaningful priorities. And those practices have proven to be viable universally across time. They apply if you're trying to manage your homework at age 12, and if you need to regroup about your corporation's strategies after your last board meeting, and to everything in between. What follows is a compilation of more than 3 decades worth of discoveries about personal and organizational productivity, a guide to maximizing output and minimizing input, and to doing so in a world in which work is increasingly voluminous, ever-shifting, and ambiguous. I, and many colleagues, have spent hundreds of thousands of hours coaching some of the brightest and busiest people you can imagine, in the trenches, at their desks, in their homes, with their doors closed, helping them capture, clarify, and organize all of their work and commitments at hand. The methods I have uncovered have proved to be highly effective in all types of organizations, at every job level, across cultures, and even at home and school. After years of coaching and training some of the most sophisticated and productive professionals, along with their kids, I know the world is hungry for these methods. Executives at the top are looking to instill a standard of ruthless execution in themselves, their staffs, and their cultures, as well as how to keep their personal lives appropriately in balance and in play. They know, and I know, that behind closed doors, after hours, there remain unanswered calls, tasks to be delegated, unprocessed issues from meetings and conversations, senior-level accountabilities not yet clarified and under control, personal responsibilities unmanaged, and dozens of potentially important emails amid their hundreds or even thousands still not dealt with. Many of these business people are successful because the crises they resolve and the opportunities they take advantage of are bigger than the problems they allow and create in their own offices, homes, and briefcases. But given the pace of business and life today, the equation is often in question. And more critically for many, people are not paying appropriate attention to their kids' school plays, sports games, or going to bed questions about life, or they're simply not able to be here now, anywhere, anytime. An ambient angst pervades our society. There's a sense that somehow there's probably something we should be doing that we're not, which creates a tension for which there is no resolution and from which there is no rest. On the one hand, we need proven tools that can help people focus their energies strategically and tactically without letting anything fall through the cracks. On the other, we need to create thinking habits and working environments that will keep the most caring and engaged people from burning out due to stress. We need positive work and lifestyle standards that will attract and retain the best and brightest in our organizations. And we need personal and home practices that foster clarity, control, and creativity for those we love, and most important, for ourselves. We know this information is sorely needed in organizations. It's also needed in schools, where the vast majority of our kids are still not being taught how to process information, how to focus on outcomes, or what actions to take to make them happen. And for all of us individually, it's needed so we can take advantage of all the opportunities we're given to add value to our world in a sustainable, self-nurturing way. The power, simplicity, and effectiveness of what I'll be presenting here is best experienced as an experience, in real time, with situations in your real world. As you listen, you will no doubt be motivated to think about how you would and could implement what I'll be talking about. You'll be greatly served by actually doing what you hear as it occurs. That will take your understanding to a much deeper and more significant level. You'll find it useful to understand the models. You'll likely find it transformational to apply them. Necessarily, the book must put the essence of this dynamic art of workflow management and personal productivity into a linear format. I've tried to organize it in such a way as to give you both the inspiring big picture view and a taste of immediate results as you go along. The book is divided into three parts. Part one describes the whole game, providing a brief overview of the system and an explanation of why it's unique and timely, and then presenting the basic methodologies themselves in their most condensed and basic form. Part two shows you how to implement the system. It's your personal coaching, step-by-step, on the nitty-gritty application of the models. Part three goes even deeper, describing the subtler and more profound results you can expect when you incorporate the methodologies and models into your work and your life. There will be inevitable repetition in the content in the three parts. The core methodology is relatively simple, but it can be expressed and understood at many different levels of depth and detail through the various lenses and lessons here. I want you to hop in, test this stuff out, even challenge it. I want you to find out for yourself that what I promise is not only possible, but instantly accessible to you personally. And I want you to know that everything I propose is easy to do. It involves no new skills at all. You already know how to focus, how to write things down, how to decide outcomes and actions, and how to review options and make choices. You'll validate that many of the things you've been doing instinctively and intuitively all along are right. I'll give you ways to leverage those basic skills into new plateaus of effectiveness. I want to inspire you to put all this into a new behavior set that will blow your mind. From time to time in the book, I refer to my work with people applying this material. I've been a management consultant, executive coach, and trainer for the past 3 decades, alone, in small partnerships, and as founder of a global training company. My work has consisted primarily of doing private coaching, conducting workshops, and giving presentations based on the methods presented here. I and my colleagues have now worked with thousands of people individually and trained hundreds of thousands in our in-house and public seminars around the world. We continue to engage with some of the best and brightest people all over the world. This is the background from which I've drawn my experience and examples. I am a fellow student. I throw myself out of control and lose my focus along with the rest and best of us. I equally must engage regularly with the practices I describe here to keep myself clear with an optimal presence of mind. As I've described in Chapter 15, this is a set of lifelong lifestyle habits that must be applied to engage in the world at more elevated and mature levels. I don't share anything in this book I've not personally experienced and tested for its validity, and that I don't continue to use in some form. The promise here was well described by a client of mine who wrote, "When I habitually applied the tenets of this program, it saved my life. When I faithfully applied them, it changed my life. This is the vaccination against day-to-day firefighting, the so-called urgent and crisis demands of any given workday, and an antidote for the imbalance many people bring upon themselves." Part 1. The Art of Getting Things Done. Chapter 1. A New Practice for a New Reality. It's possible for a person to have an overwhelming number of things to do and still function productively with a clear head and a positive sense of relaxed control. That's a great way to live and work at elevated levels of effectiveness and efficiency. It's also the best way to be fully present with whatever you're doing, appropriately engaged in the moment. It's when time disappears and your attention is completely at your command. What you're doing is exactly what you ought to be doing, given the whole spectrum of your commitments and interests. You're fully available. You're on. This is an operational style now critical for successful, high-performing professionals, a necessary mode for the sanity of anyone experiencing overextended life situations, and a fundamental platform to allow all of us the freedom to involve ourselves optimally in our most meaningful endeavors. You already know how to do everything necessary to achieve this healthy, high-performance state. If you're like most people, however, you need to apply these skills in a more timely, complete, and systematic way so you can get on top of it all instead of feeling buried. And though the method and the techniques I describe in this book are immensely practical and based on common sense, most people will still have some major habits that must be modified before they can fully enjoy the benefits of this system. The small changes required, changes in the way you clarify and organize all the things that command your attention, could represent a significant alteration in how you approach some key aspects of your day-to-day activities. But the results are often reported as transformational. The methods I present here are all based on three key objectives. 1. Capturing all the things that might need to get done or have usefulness for you, now, later, someday, big, little, or in between, in a logical and trusted system outside your head and off your mind. 2. Directing yourself to make front-end decisions about all of the inputs you let into your life so that you will always have a workable inventory of next actions that you can implement or renegotiate in the moment. And 3. Curating and coordinating all of that content, utilizing the recognition of the multiple levels of commitments with yourself and others you will have at play at any point in time. This book offers a proven method for this kind of high-performance workflow management. It provides good tools, tips, techniques, and tricks for implementation. As you'll discover, the principles and methods are instantly usable and applicable to everything you have to do in your personal as well as your professional life. I consider work, in its most universal sense, to mean anything that you want or need to be different than it currently is. Many people make a distinction between work and personal life, but I don't. To me, weeding the garden or updating my will is just as much work as writing this book or coaching a client. All the methods and techniques in this book are applicable across that life-work spectrum. To be effective, they need to be. You can incorporate, as many others have before you, what I describe as an ongoing dynamic style of operating in your work and in your world. Or, like still others, you can simply use this as a guide to getting back into better control when you feel you need to. The problem: new demands, insufficient resources. Almost everyone I encounter these days feels he or she has too much to handle and not enough time to get it all done. In the course of a single week, I consulted with a partner in a major global investment firm who was concerned that the new corporate management responsibilities he was being offered would stress his family commitments beyond the limits, and with a mid-level human resources manager trying to stay on top of her 150-plus email requests per day, fueled by the goal of doubling the company's regional office staff from 1,100 to 2,000 people in 1 year, all as she tried to protect a social life for herself on the weekends. A paradox has emerged in this new millennium. People have enhanced quality of life, but at the same time, they are adding to their stress levels by taking on more than they have resources to handle. It's as though their eyes were bigger than their stomachs. The plethora of options and opportunities brings with it the pressures of decision-making and choices. And most people are, to some degree, frustrated and perplexed about how to improve the situation. Work no longer has clear boundaries. A major factor in the mounting stress level is that the actual nature of our jobs has changed much more dramatically and rapidly than have our training for and our ability to deal with work. In just the last half of the 20th century, what constituted work in the industrialized world was transformed from assembly line, make it and move it kinds of activity to what the late Peter Drucker so aptly termed knowledge work. In the old days, work was self-evident. Fields were to be plowed, machines tooled, boxes packed, cows milked, crates moved. You knew what work had to be done. You could see it. It was clear when the work was finished or not finished. Increasing your productivity was all about making the work process more efficient or simply working harder or longer. Now, for many of us, there are no edges to most of our projects. Most people I know have at least half a dozen things they're trying to achieve or situations they'd like to improve right now, and even if they had the rest of their lives to try, they wouldn't be able to finish these to perfection. You're probably faced with the same dilemma. How good could that conference be? How effective could the training program be? Or the structure of your executive's compensation package? How well could you manage your kid's education? How close to perfect is the blog you're writing? How motivating is the staff meeting you're setting up? How healthy could you be? How functional is your department's reorganization? And a last question. How much available data could be relevant to doing those projects better? The answer is an infinite amount, easily accessible, or at least potentially so, through the Internet. On another front, the lack of edges can create more work for everyone. Many of today's organizational outcomes require cross-divisional communication, cooperation, and engagement. Our individual office silos are crumbling, or at least need to be, and with them is going the luxury of not having to read CC'd emails from the marketing department or from human resources or from some ad hoc deal-with-a-certain-issue committee. Add to that the increasing pull on your engagement with friends and family as distance from them disappears, with even aging parents taking to the Internet and their smartphones to stay connected. The ever-new communication technologies have exponentially magnified the lack of clear limits to our commitments and our lives. The second decade of this century witnessed an explosion of concern about the always-on conundrum, fueled by globalization, virtual work and connection capabilities, and not the least by the addiction to engaging with gadgets in our pockets and on our wrists that have more capacity than a room full of computers did in 1975. So, not only are work and its cognitive boundaries more ambiguous and ill-defined, so are the time and space within which we can and often should be engaged with it, along with the continuing explosion of potentially meaningful and accessible data that could add value to our lives. Our jobs and lives keep changing. The disintegrating edges of our projects and our work in general would be challenging enough for anyone. But now we must add to that equation the constantly shifting definition of our jobs, as well as the frequent changes in responsibilities and interests in the broader scope of our lives. I often ask in my seminar, which of you are doing only what you were hired to do? And how many of you have not had any significant change in your personal life in the past year? Seldom do I get a raised hand. As amorphous as edgeless work may be, if you had the chance to stick with some specifically described job long enough, you'd probably figure out what you needed to do, how much, at what level, to stay sane. And if you could keep life in general more in check, no residence moves, no relationship changes, no emerging health or lifestyle issues for you and for loved ones, no financial surprises, no motivational programs generating inspiring new directions, no career shifts thrust on you, you might be able to create a rhythm and system of managing it that would allow for some relaxed stability. But few have that luxury, for three reasons. One, organizations are now almost universally in morph mode, with ever-changing goals, products, partners, customers, markets, technologies, and owners. These all, by necessity, shake up structures, forms, roles, and accountabilities. Two, the average professional is more of a free agent these days than ever before, changing careers as often as his or her parents once changed jobs. Even 40 and 50-somethings hold to standards of continual growth. Their aims are just more integrated into the mainstream now, covered by the catch-all arena of professional management and executive development, which simply means they won't keep doing what they're doing for any extended period of time. The Great Recession early in this century added to the uncertainties by creating the need for many to keep working after traditional retirement ages, often requiring the discovery of some other way to make money. Three, the relative speed of changes in our cultures, lifestyles, and technologies are creating greater necessity for individuals to take more control of their unique personal situations more often. Suddenly needing to handle elder care for a parent, dealing with a kid now back at home without a job, grappling with an unexpected health issue, or integrating a major change one's life partner has decided to initiate, all such seem to be happening with greater frequency, with larger consequences than ever before. Little seems clear for very long anymore, as far as what to do at the office, at home, on the plane, in the car, and at the local cafe, on the weekend, on Monday morning, on waking at 3 a.m., and on vacation, and what or how much input may be relevant to doing it well. We're allowing in huge amounts of information and communication from the outer world and generating an equally large volume of ideas and agreements with others and ourselves from the inner world. and we haven't been well equipped to deal with this huge number of internal and external commitments. Nothing is really new in this high-tech, globally wired world, except how frequently it is. When the pace of change in life and work was much slower, once people got past the inevitable discomfort of the new, they could hang out on cruise control for greatly extended periods of time. Most of us are now living in a world that does not afford that time-out kind of luxury. It's changing while you're listening to this. And if, while you have been listening to this, you've been distracted by your mind wandering to other things going on in your life, or you've felt impelled to check email for potentially meaningful new input, you're experiencing a manifestation of this don't-miss-the-train syndrome. The old models and habits are insufficient. Neither our standard education, nor traditional time management models, nor the plethora of digital and paper-based organizing tools available has given us a viable means of meeting the new demands placed on us. If you've tried to use any of these processes or tools, you've probably found them unable to accommodate the speed, complexity, and changing priority factors inherent in what you're doing. The ability to be focused, relaxed, and in control during these fertile but turbulent and often unstructured times demands new ways of thinking and working. There is a great need for new methods, technologies, and work habits to help us get on top of our world. The traditional approaches to time management and personal organization were useful in their time. They provided helpful reference points for a workforce that was just emerging from an industrial assembly line modality into a new kind of work that included choices about what to do and discretion about when to do it. When time itself turned into a work factor, personal calendars became a key work tool. Even in the 1980s, many professionals considered having a pocket calendar the essence of being organized, and many people today still think of their calendar and possibly their email and text inboxes as the central tools for being in control. Along with discretionary time came the need to make good choices about what to do. Creating ABC priority codes and daily to-do lists were key techniques developed to help people sort through their choices in some meaningful way. If you had the freedom to decide what to do, you also had the responsibility to make good choices, given your priorities. What you've probably discovered, at least at some level, is that a calendar, though important, can really effectively manage only a small portion of what you need to be aware of to feel on top of your world. And daily to-do lists and simplified priority coding have proven inadequate in dealing with the volume and variable nature of the average person's workload. More and more people's jobs and lives are made up of hundreds of emails and texts today, with no latitude left to ignore a single request, complaint, order, or communication from company or family. There are few people who can, or even should, expect to code everything based upon its priority, or who can maintain some predetermined list of to-dos that the first telephone call or instant message or interruption from their boss or spouse won't totally undo. The big picture versus the nitty-gritty. At the other end of the spectrum, a huge number of business books, models, seminars, and gurus have championed the bigger view as the solution to dealing with our complex world. Clarifying major goals and values, so the thinking goes, gives order, meaning, and direction to our work. In practice, however, the well-intentioned exercise of values thinking too often does not achieve its desired results. I have seen too many of these efforts fail for one or more of the following three reasons. 1. There's too much distraction at the day-to-day, hour-to-hour level of commitments to allow for appropriate focus on the higher levels. 2. Ineffective personal organizational systems create huge subconscious resistance to undertaking even bigger projects and goals that will likely not be managed well and that will, in turn, cause even more distraction and stress. 3. When loftier levels and values actually are clarified, it raises the bar of our standards, making us notice that much more that needs changing. We are already having a serious negative reaction to the overwhelming number of things we have to do. And what created much of the work that's on those lists in the first place? Our values. Focusing on primary outcomes and values is a critical exercise, certainly. It provides needed criteria for making sometimes difficult choices about what to stop doing as well as what most ought to have our attention amid our excess of options. But it does not mean that there is less to do or fewer challenges in getting the work done. Quite the contrary, it just ups the ante in the game, which still must be played day to day. For a human resources executive, for example, deciding to deal with quality of work-life issues in order to attract and keep key talent does not make things simpler. Nor would there be less to do for a mother recognizing the importance of providing valuable experiences for her teenage daughter in the few vacations left they may take together before she leaves home for work or college. Upping the quality of our thinking and commitments does not diminish the quantity of potentially relevant and important stuff to manage. There has been a missing piece in our culture of knowledge work, a system with a coherent set of behaviors and tools that functions effectively at the level at which work really happens. It must incorporate the results of big-picture thinking as well as the smallest of open details. It must manage multiple tiers of priorities. It must maintain control over hundreds of new inputs daily. It must save a lot more time and effort than are needed to maintain it. It must make it easier to get things done. The promise, the ready state of the martial artist. Reflect for a moment on what it actually might be like if your personal management situation were totally under control, at all levels and at all times. What if you had completely clear mental space, with nothing pulling or pushing on you unproductively? What if you could dedicate fully 100% of your attention to whatever was at hand, at your own choosing, with no distraction? It is possible. There is a way to get a grip on it all, stay relaxed, and get meaningful things done with minimal effort across the whole spectrum of your life and work. You can experience what the martial artists call a mind like water, and top athletes refer to as the zone, within the complex world in which you're engaged. In fact, you have probably already been in this state from time to time. It's a condition of working, doing, and being in which the mind is clear and constructive things are happening. It's a state that is accessible to everyone, and one that is increasingly needed to deal effectively with the complexity of life in this century. More and more, it will be a required condition for any of us who wish to maintain balance and a consistent positive output in our work and outlook in our life. World-class rower Craig Lambert has described how it feels in Mind Over Water, Houghton Mifflin, 1998. He wrote, "Rowers have a word for this frictionless state, swing. Recall the pure joy of riding on a backyard swing. An easy cycle of motion, the momentum coming from the swing itself. The swing carries us. We do not force it. We pump our legs to drive our arc higher, but gravity does most of the work. We are not so much swinging as being swung. The boat swings you. The shell wants to move fast. Speed sings in its lines in nature. Our job is simply to work with the shell, to stop holding it back with our thrashing struggles to go faster. Trying too hard sabotages boat speed. Trying becomes striving, and striving undoes itself. Social climbers strive to be aristocrats, but their efforts prove them no such thing. Aristocrats do not strive. They have already arrived. Swing is a state of arrival." The mind-like-water simile. In karate, there's an image that's used to define the position of perfect readiness. Mind like water. Imagine throwing a pebble into a still pond. How does the water respond? The answer is, totally appropriately to the force and mass of the input, then it returns to calm. It doesn't overreact or underreact. Water is what it is and does what it does. It can overwhelm, but it's not overwhelmed. It can be still, but it is not impatient. It can be forced to change course, but it is not frustrated. Get it? The power in a karate punch comes from speed, not muscle. It comes from a focused pop at the end of the whip. That's why petite people can learn to break boards and bricks with their hands. It doesn't take calluses or brute strength, just the ability to generate a focused thrust with speed. But a tense muscle is a slow one. So the high levels of training in the martial arts teach and demand balance and relaxation as much as anything else. Clearing the mind to being open and appropriately responsive is the key. Anything that causes you to overreact or underreact can control you, and often does. Responding inappropriately to your email, your thoughts about what you need to do, your children, or your boss will lead to less effective results than you'd like. Most people give either more or less attention to things than they deserve, simply because they don't operate with a mind like water. Can you get into your productive state when required? Think about the last time you felt highly productive. You probably had a sense of being in control. You were not stressed out. You were highly focused on what you were doing. Time tended to disappear. Lunchtime already? And you felt you were making noticeable progress toward a meaningful outcome. Would you like to have more such experiences? And if you get seriously far out of that state and start to feel out of control, stressed out, unfocused, bored, and stuck, do you have the ability to get yourself back into it? That's where the methodology of getting things done will have the greatest impact on your life, by showing you how to get back to mind like water, with all your resources and faculties functioning at a maximum level. A challenge for many may be the lack of a reference point as to when they fall out of the productive state. Most people have lived in a semi-stressful experience so consistently for so long, they don't know that it could be quite different, that there is another and more positive place from which to engage with their world. Hopefully, this book will inspire you to raise the bar about how much pressure you will allow yourself to tolerate, knowing you have the techniques to reduce it. The principle: dealing effectively with internal commitments. A basic truism I've discovered over decades of coaching and training thousands of people is that most stress they experience comes from inappropriately managed commitments they make or accept. Even those who are not consciously stressed out will invariably experience greater relaxation, better focus, and increased productive energy when they learn more effectively to control the open loops of their lives. You've probably made many more agreements with yourself than you realize, and every single one of them, big or little, is being tracked by a less than conscious part of you. These are the incompletes, or open loops, which I define as anything pulling at your attention that doesn't belong where it is, the way it is. Open loops can include everything from really big to-do items, like end world hunger, to the more modest, hire new assistant, to the tiniest task, such as replace porch light bulb. In order to deal effectively with all of that, you must first identify and capture all of those things that are ringing your bell in some way, clarify what exactly they mean to you, and then make a decision about how to move on them. That may seem like a simple process, but in reality, most people don't do it in a consistent way. They lack the knowledge or the motivation, or both, and most likely because they aren't aware of the prices paid for neglecting that practice. The basic requirements for managing commitments. Managing commitments well requires the implementation of some basic activities and behaviors. First of all, if it's on your mind isn't clear. Anything you consider unfinished in any way must be captured in a trusted system outside your mind, or what I call a collection tool, that you know you'll come back to regularly and sort through. Second, you must clarify exactly what your commitment is and decide what you have to do, if anything, to make progress toward fulfilling it. Third, once you've decided on all the actions you need to take, you must keep reminders of them organized in a system you review regularly. An important exercise to test this model. I suggest that you write down the project or situation that is most on your mind at this moment. What most bugs you, distracts you, or interest you, or in some other way consumes a large part of your conscious attention. It may be a project or a problem that is really in your face, something you're being pressed to handle, or a situation you feel you must deal with sooner rather than later. Maybe you have a holiday trip coming up that you need to make some major last-minute decisions about. You just read an email about a new and pressing issue in your department. Or perhaps you just inherited $6 million and you don't know what to do with the cash. Whatever. Got it? Good. Now describe in a single written sentence your intended successful outcome for this problem or situation. In other words, What would need to happen for you to check this project off as done? It could be as simple as take the Hawaii vacation, handle situation with customer X, resolve college situation with Susan, clarify new divisional management structure, implement new investment strategy, or research options for dealing with Manuel's reading issue. All clear? Great. Now write down the very next physical action required to move the situation forward. If you had nothing else to do in your life but get closure on this, what visible action would you take right now? Would you call or text someone? Write an email? Take pen and paper and brainstorm about it? Surf the web for data? Buy nails at the hardware store? Talk about it face-to-face with your partner, your assistant, your attorney, or your boss? What? Got the answer to that? Good. Was there any value for you in those 2 minutes of thinking? If you're like the vast majority of people who complete that drill in our seminars, you'll be experiencing at least a tiny bit of enhanced control, relaxation, and focus. You'll also be feeling more motivated to actually do something about that situation you've merely been thinking about till now. Imagine that motivation magnified 1,000-fold as a way to live and work. If anything at all positive happened for you in this little exercise, think about this. What changed? What happened to create that improved condition within your own experience? The situation itself is no further along, at least in the physical world. It's certainly not finished yet. What probably happened is that you acquired a clearer definition of the outcome desired and the next action required. What did change is the most important element for clarity, focus, and peace of mind, how you are engaged with your world. But what created that? Not getting organized or setting priorities. The answer is thinking. Not a lot, just enough to solidify your commitment about a discrete pressure or opportunity and the resources required to deal with it. People think a lot, but most of that thinking is of a problem, project, or situation, not about it. If you actually did this suggested exercise, you were required to structure your thinking toward an outcome and an action, and that does not usually happen without a consciously focused effort. Reacting is automatic, but thinking is not. The real work of knowledge work. Welcome to the real-life experience of knowledge work and a profound operational principle. You have to think about your stuff more than you realize, but not as much as you're afraid you might. As Peter Drucker wrote, in knowledge work, the task is not given, it has to be determined. What are the expected results from this work is the key question in making knowledge workers productive, and it is a question that demands risky decisions. There is usually no right answer. There are choices instead, and results have to be clearly specified if productivity is to be achieved. Knowledge work may seem an unfamiliar concept to many in this century, simply because so much of our lives now incorporate so many non-physical and non-obvious things we need to decide, demanding constant thinking and choices. Most of us are in it all the time. The last thing a fish notices is water. But the realization of the thinking process itself that we must be applying is not explicitly realized or exercised yet by most. Knowledge work may seem an idea limited to white-collar professionals. That was the initial population in the past century that dealt with this, but anyone who has moved out of mere survival mode finds himself or herself in this game. Any parent who has ever wondered what class to choose for a child or what digital device to give him or her is in this category. Most people have a resistance to initiating the burst of energy that it will take to clarify the real meaning for them of something they have let into their world and to decide what they need to do about it. We're never really taught that we have to think about our work before we can do it. Much of our daily activity is already defined for us by the undone and unmoved things staring at us when we come to work, or by the family to be fed, the laundry to be done, or the children to be dressed at home. Thinking in a concentrated manner to define desired outcomes and requisite next actions is something few people feel they have to do until they have to. But in truth, it is the most effective means available for making wishes a reality. Why things are on your mind. Most often, the reason something is on your mind is that you want it to be different than it currently is. And yet, you haven't clarified exactly what the intended outcome is. You haven't decided what the very next physical action step is. And, or, you haven't put reminders of the outcome and the action required in a system you trust. That's why it's on your mind. Until those thoughts have been clarified and those decisions made, and the resulting data has been stored in a system that you absolutely know you will access and think about when you need to, your brain can't give up the job. You can fool everyone else, but you can't fool your own mind. It knows whether or not you've come to the conclusions you need to, and whether you've put the resulting outcomes and action reminders in a place that can be trusted to resurface appropriately within your conscious mind. I'll discuss validating research in more detail in Chapter 14. If you haven't done those things, it won't quit working overtime. Even if you've already decided on the next step you'll take to resolve a problem, your mind can't let go until and unless you park a reminder in a place it knows you will without fail look. It will keep pressuring you about that untaken next step, usually when you can't do anything about it, which will just add to your stress. Your mind doesn't have a mind of its own. At least a portion of your mind is really kind of stupid in an interesting way. If it had any innate intelligence and logic, it would remind you of the things you needed to do only when you could do something about them. Do you have a flashlight somewhere with dead batteries in it? When does your mind tend to remind you that you need more batteries? When you notice the dead ones. That's not very smart. If your mind had any innate intelligence, it would remind you about those dead batteries only when you passed new ones in a store, and ones of the right size to boot. Between the time you woke up today and now, did you think of anything you needed to do that you still haven't done? Have you had that thought more than once? Why? It's a waste of time and energy to keep thinking about something that you make no progress on. And it only adds to your anxiety about what you should be doing and aren't. Most people let their reactive mental process run a lot of the show, especially where the too much to do syndrome is concerned. You've probably given over a lot of your stuff, a lot of your open loops, to an entity on your inner committee that is incapable of dealing with those things effectively the way they are, your mind. Research has now proven that a significant part of your psyche cannot help but keep track of your open loops, and not, as originally thought, as an intelligent, positive motivator, but as a detractor from anything else you need or want to think about, diminishing your capacity to perform. The transformation of stuff. Here's how I define stuff. Anything you have allowed into your psychological or physical world that doesn't belong where it is, but for which you haven't yet determined what exactly it means to you with the desired outcome and the next action step. The reason most organizing systems haven't worked for most people is that they haven't yet transformed all the stuff they're trying to organize. As long as it's still stuff, it's not controllable. Almost all of the to-do lists I have seen over the years, when people had them at all, were merely listings of stuff, not inventories of the resultant real work that needed to be done. They were partial reminders of a lot of things that were unresolved and as yet untranslated into outcomes and actions. That is, the real outlines and details of what the list maker had to do. Typical things you will see on a to-do list. Mom. Bank. Doctor. Babysitter. VP marketing. Etc. Looking at these often creates more stress than relief because, though it is a valuable trigger for something that you've committed to do or decide something about, it still calls out psychologically, "Decide about me." And if you do not have the energy or focus at the moment to think and decide, it will simply remind you that you are overwhelmed. Stuff is not inherently a bad thing. Things that command or attract our attention, by their very nature, usually show up as stuff. But once we allow stuff to come into our lives and work, we have an inherent commitment to ourselves to define and clarify its meaning. In the professional world, our jobs require us to think, assess, decide, and execute, minute by minute, whether about an email or our notes from the morning strategy meeting. That's inherent in your job. If you didn't have to think about those things, you're probably not required to. And personally, We will shortchange ourselves when we allow issues in our daily lifestyle, home, family, health, finances, career, or relationships, to lie fallow in our consciousness because of lack of definition of the specific outcomes desired and actions required. At the conclusion of one of my seminars, a senior manager of a major biotech firm looked back at the to-do list she had come in with and said, "Boy, that was an amorphous blob of undoability." That's the best description I have ever heard about what passes for organizing lists in most systems. The vast majority of people have been trying to get organized by rearranging incomplete lists of unclear things. They haven't yet realized how much and what they need to organize in order to get the real payoff. They need to gather everything that requires thinking about and then do that thinking if their organizational efforts are to be successful. The process. Managing action. You can train yourself almost like an athlete to be faster, more responsive, more proactive, and more focused in dealing with all the things you need to deal with. You can think more effectively and manage the results with more ease and control. You can minimize the loose ends across the whole spectrum of your work life and personal life and get a lot more done with less effort. And you can make front-end decision-making about all the stuff you collect and create standard operating procedure for living and working in this millennium. Before you can achieve any of that, though, you'll need to get in the habit of keeping nothing on your mind. And the way to do that, as we've seen, is not by managing time, managing information, or managing priorities. After all, you don't manage 5 minutes and wind up with six. You don't manage information overload, otherwise you'd walk into a library and die, or the first time you connected to the web, you'd blow up. And you don't manage priorities. You have them. Instead, the key to managing all of your stuff is managing your actions. Managing action is the prime challenge. What you do with your time, what you do with information, and what you do with your body and your focus relative to your priorities, those are the real options to which you must allocate your limited resources. The substantive issue is how to make appropriate choices about what to do at any point in time. The real work is to manage our actions. That may sound obvious. However, it might amaze you to discover how many next actions for how many projects and commitments remain undetermined by most people. It's extremely difficult to manage actions you haven't identified or decided on. Most people have dozens of things that they need to do to make progress on many fronts, but they don't yet know what they are. And the common complaint that I don't have time to, fill in the blank, is understandable because many projects seem overwhelming, and are overwhelming because you can't do a project at all. You can only do an action related to it. Many actions require only a minute or two, in the appropriate context, to move a project forward. In training and coaching many thousands of people, I have found that lack of time is not the major issue for them, though they may think it is. The real problem is a lack of clarity and definition about what a project really is and what associated next action steps are required. Clarifying things on the front end, when they first appear on the radar, rather than on the back end after trouble has developed, allows people to reap the benefits of managing action. Getting things done requires two basic components. Defining, one, what done means, outcome, and two, what doing looks like, action. And these are far from self-evident for most people about most things that have their attention. The value of a bottom-up approach. I've discovered over the years the practical value of working on personal productivity improvement from the bottom up, starting with the most mundane, ground floor level of current activity and commitments. Intellectually, the most appropriate way ought to be to work from the top down, first uncovering personal and organizational purpose and vision, then defining critical objectives, and finally focusing on the details of implementation. The trouble is, however, that most people are so embroiled in commitments on a day-to-day level that their ability to focus successfully on the larger horizon is seriously impaired. Consequently, a bottom-up approach is usually more effective.